your digital will, and you basically, you know, you give us all of your passwords and we'll unlock them when you die. And first of all, no. Secondly, no. And thirdly, I'm not at all convinced that these people will be around years and years from now when you two die. Me, since I'll probably die, you know, next year or something. Maybe different. But
not a whole lot of confidence. Brief hiatus. Welcome back to Bad Voltage.
Yep.
Yay! Yep.
Wow, look at the excitement.
That was enthusiastic.
Wow. I know. That was
quite enthusiastic.
Trying to bring the love to people, you know, is what it's all about.
You can keep your love to yourself, by the way. We don't want any of that. So, welcome back, everybody.
Welcome back to Season 2, Episode 35. So, what are we going to talk about in this episode?
Well,
go ahead, Langridge.
I want to talk about what you should do with your data when you die, or specifically since you'll be dead, what should be done with your data after you're dead. Do you give people access to it or not? How do you do that? All this kind of thing. So
it's a bright and breezy segment.
Yeah, deep thoughts on mortality and two-factor authentication.
Yes, indeed. And we are also going to... Previously, we have done bumper news. And then we have surpassed that level of bumperarity. It's a word now. This week, we're going to have an even more bumper set of news. In fact, we're only going to get through about half of the news that we have because we run out of time. So lots of really exciting stuff in there. We're going to be talking about Python, about Google, about the Linux Foundation, about hilarious Jeremy Corbyn things that have been going on recently. So stay tuned for that.
Also, bumperality, not a word, but... Despite that, and now, Bad Voltage.
You know what it's time for?
You don't have to have this stupid introduction every time we do the news.
Every
segment.
Single time.
I like it. It adds character and depth.
It adds no character and no depth. Of those things is what it adds. Right. Loads of stuff has gone on.
Yes.
Especially since we skipped a show. So, name your news. John O'Bacon, you can start.
Why don't we start out with a little bit of Linux news here. SUSE, venerable, quite old Linux distribution. How long has SUSE been around for?
Oh, forever.
Forever, right? Was sold for $2.5 billion.
It was.
Yep, so Micro Focus, who owns SUSE, has sold SUSE Linux and its associated software business to a Swedish private equity firm, EQT Partners, for $2.535 billion. So, my question here is, and given the fact that valuations for software companies, it seems to be some kind of, game of roulette for a lot of people. What do you think about that number? Does that seem high? Does that seem low? Because I think SUSE have done some interesting work in the enterprise. Like, you don't hear about them in the general open source press quite so often. Mm-hmm. But $2.5 billion seemed high to me, but I don't know whether they're selling products that, you just don't hear of very often, but offer a lot of value.
What,
so.
It's 26 times adjusted operating profit just for a measuring stick.
Okay.
Yeah. I
did not know that.
I'll tell you, the first thing I thought about that number, 2.535 billion, is I thought, seriously, you quoted it to three decimal places. But then you think, right, 2.535 billion, that last five is $5 million. Which is.
I think what's interesting is to follow the kind of progression of this, because this is a Linux company that's been sold far more times than any of the other major ones, right? So if you look at, they were originally sold, what was it for? Let me get the number here. 210. So $210 million in 2003 to Novell.
Yes.
Novell sold them in 10 for $2.2 billion.
Yeah.
And then...
In 2010? For $2.2 billion?
to attach mate.
Right.
To attach mate. You remember attach mate?
And then attach mate then merged with Micro Focus.
Yep.
And then Micro Focus sponsors back off at 2.5. So that's quite a bit of different sales, I think. Which
so the valuation is not going to very much at all in 8 years.
It's better. I don't think that's even kept pace with inflation, is it? I mean, that feels to me like Micro Focus made a loss on it.
Right. Maybe that's right. No.
I mean, Novell was acquired for $2.2
billion. Oh,
not SUSE. All of Novell. Which I thought was worth
way
than
different.
That.
Okay, yeah. I forgot about that. Really? All attach rate bought the whole good work, Novell? Okay, right.
Yeah, so NetWare was basically worth nothing by that point, so they sold a little late, but.
Yeah. Wow, that's blimey. Okay, so, yeah, I mean, to me, $2.5 billion seems a lot for SUSE.
Seems like a lot to me. Yeah, it seems like a lot to me as well.
It's like you don't hear that much about whether the you know, people like Richard Brown are hopping up and down to their chair going, we do loads. Why don't you care?
Yeah. But they put out those music videos, right?
But you don't hear that much about stuff they don't. I mean, they've got a pretty firm enterprise base of people out there who are paying them money and so on and so forth.
They do a lot of SAP, they do a lot of more on the enterprise side.
They do, and they've got a strong European play, obviously, you know, given given their history and so on. But to me it seemed like a lot of money.
Yeah.
Kind of sets the market for Canonical, who wants the IPO, as a measuring stick, I think, which also makes it interesting from a timing perspective.
No, that's a very good point, actually. And they can point to a bunch of other stuff that they're doing and so on. So,
I wonder what this means for how Mark will think of Canonical, because I remember reading in the press somewhere that that Mark had talked to some potential companies for an acquisition, and the number floated was $2 billion. And I would argue that Ubuntu and Canonical is much more relevant in today's cloud ecosystem than SUSE. So I wonder whether Mark's now thinking, this should be more towards 3 or 4 billion, you know?
So he's going to want a higher multiple on valuation as far as compared to revenue goes, because cloud growth is obviously higher than enterprise growth.
Right, exactly.
Not knowing what that revenue is, I mean, I don't know what impact that has on the valuation.
And I don't know who EQT Partners is or what they do.
It's a Swedish PE firm.
Right. But that's all I know about them. Like, I have no idea they're acquiring them.
I don't know. I don't particularly know what their goal is. No one seems to be very clear about it. Based on, reading I did, no one's very sure why it's EQT rather than different equity group, and why EQT are going for SUSE rather than something completely different.
Yeah. All right.
I don't know. Jeremy, did you see any more indication of why they thought this was a particularly good buy?
I didn't know.
No, I didn't either. So it's all a bit of a mystery. I'm assuming it's not going to actually have that much effect on what SUSE are doing day to day, but we shall find out.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. Yeah. Okay. Who knows? Jeremy. We'll stay as maddeningly complicated as it's always been. I haven't used Yas for like 10 years. That was completely unfair. All right. What's next, Jeremy? Give us some sugar.
Wow. So why don't we go with something we've talked about on a couple shows recently, is the current cryptocurrency prices and kind of the markets. And one thing that we hadn't talked about is the impact that had on graphics cards, which it turns out was pretty substantial. In this case, it actually mostly wasn't Bitcoin, because most Bitcoin mining has moved to ASICs, but Ether is the second most valuable cryptocurrency and still is able to be mined on a GPU. And it turns out the price of most higher-end NVIDIA and AMD graphics cards has somewhere in between doubled and quadrupled, depending on the specific card, over the last, 18 to 24 months.
Yeah.
And now with prices coming back down, the cards are coming back down to the range that they were. I just thought it was interesting that it had that much of an impact. So if you look at like the RX 570, which is a Radeon, kind of a mid-range card, the MSRP is 200, which is what it sold for in April of 2017. Just a few months later, in February of 18, was going for over 450.
Yeah, it had a huge effect. It's, yeah. It's nuts. It always surprises me when something which I don't think is a big deal has this kind of outsized effect on stuff you hear about. Do you remember when people were going through rubbish dumps looking for old circuit boards for the value of the copper on them?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's genuinely surprising to me. But yeah, people do seem to be happier
and,
that this is
And
happening.
This hasn't just, from what I understand, this hasn't just affected graphics cards. It's affected RAM as well and some other components. So,
yeah.
Because I know that when I was buying, when I was building my studio computer, which was towards the tail end of last year, the guy who bought our old house works for a fairly prominent tech company. And he's really into gaming, like a gaming company. And he was saying that, you know, he said, you built a PC at the worst possible time. He said, because like prices are completely through the roof right now.
Yeah.
And it's all because of crypto. So,
yeah.
Stop
doing crypto things entirely, for goodness sake.
Hey, people need the Dogecoin.
They really don't.
All right. Come on. Give us something, language.
Right. Okay. A brief one.
Yes.
Google is now a platinum member of the Linux Foundation, apparently.
Yeah.
I don't know whether this is because they use a great deal of Linux and they want to contribute more, or, you know, as a kind of red cape things that bullfighters use to distract you from fuchsia lurking around the corner, or
a bit... I think it's Kubernetes. I think that's
I was going to say, don't forget that Linux Foundation is CNCF and CNCF is Kubernetes. So
oh, yeah, no,
not
true.
Surprising at all,
yeah.
I guess.
But yeah, no. Nonetheless, I mean, this is a good thing, regardless, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Well played, Google.
And I think if I remember right, was it Tencent joined the LF recently as well?
Yes,
which is a fairly major deal. So, I mean, the Linux Foundation has grown like crazy. But I think they do good work. So
they seem to be getting the buy-in from large companies at least, which was always the
kind
of underlying approach to the thing.
Yeah,
okay.
I am actually, like, fuchsia's really interesting to me. This is nothing to do with the LF, but just, I'm keeping an eye on this. I think it's interesting watching this kind of grow a little bit. So Google definitely seem to be placing their bets on it. So it's still very small, though, in the company, from what I understand. I read something about this the other day, so.
Yeah.
Never tried it.
No.
I have one.
Yep.
So I read this interesting blog post from this guy called Jackson Cunningham. And basically what happened is he got banned from Airbnb and he inquired about why and they refused to tell him. He went through the process a number of times and tried to get information back. And they basically said, you're banned and we're not going to tell you why you're banned. And this blog post is kind of interesting because he basically says, you know, should there be some kind of like a clearinghouse for due process for these kinds of incidents where, you know, you have these digital services. This kind of relates to our segment about, you know, when you die, like our digital footprint is so fundamental to our lives that if you get banned from a service, it can have pretty severe implications. Now, for Airbnb, it's probably less of an implication than if you get banned on, you know, Google or G Suite or something along those lines. But should there be regulation that relates to this? Because it sounds like, and from what I've read, that Airbnb are kind of shitty in this area, that there's been a number of incidents where this kind of thing has happened, where people have been banned and they haven't been given a reason why.
I don't think it's Airbnb. I think it's tech companies in general are just not very good at customer service, especially in-person customer service. And I think the kind of the broader question is, is there a point where tech companies become so pervasive in just everyday life that they at least owe users some kind of explanation or warning before they're just silently banned and there's no process for refuting what happened or even verifying that the correct person was banned or et cetera? It's not due process. It's not a legal thing, but there's just really no process at all. So is there a point where a service is so pervasive that it should be mandatory?
Well, There are a whole bunch of rules applying to this kind of thing, but they apply to the government and the public sector. We've spent years and years and years, decades, building up rules about how you know, the government could deny you a thing, but they can't just go, we're going to deny you, we're not going to tell you why, lol, get stuffed. And you've got things like freedom of information and so on and so forth, but all this stuff just applies to the government. Now there are huge companies with this pervasive effect on life, and they're increasingly taking on a semi-public, semi-infrastructural role. Yeah.
Some are almost turning into utilities, you could argue.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, therefore, yeah, a whole bunch of this stuff ought to apply. They just hide by the fact that, no, we're a private company, we don't have to tell you anything. And I think, no, I mean, we have this discussion about the right to be forgotten, about whether is Google pervasive enough that it can be genuinely damaging to you to have stuff still up there, you know, when there are things like, you know, the statute of limitations on crimes, but not on stuff that was reported about you in Google News. And this to me feels like all part and parcel of the same thing. I think, yeah, these big companies are essentially utilities. And therefore, some of the rules that apply around things like freedom of information, around things like not just capriciously denying people and refusing to tell you about it, I think they absolutely should apply.
Well, and what's interesting in this case with this Jack Cunningham guy is it sounds like he had a, you know, a long history of staying in Airbnb properties and, you know, there were no issues and all the rest of it. And then it just seemed like he was done and that's it. He's out. And I could understand if you have like repeated violations that somebody gets banned. I can understand, for example, what Twitter have been doing about removing Russian spam bot accounts. And there's no warning. They just get removed. But if look, you know, for example, language, if you were to get if Twitter were to ban you just for no reason, given how long you've been on the platform, how long you've used it, you've had no issues against it or against you, that would be weird to me. So, yeah.
Yeah.
This was an odd one.
I mean, Google thought PayPal deleted my account. And you'll see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people complaining about this over time, about exactly this. PayPal could just go, nah, we're going to cut you off, and we don't have to tell you why, and we're not interested in your opinion. Get stuffed. Catch you later. And
now,
there's nothing you can do about it, because they're just a company whose services you have chosen to use.
And this is tricky, because the capitalist argument here will be, vote with your feet, go somewhere else, don't use their service, blah, 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 blah. The other side of the viewpoint is that you have some kind of government ruling or legislation that kind of deals with that and then gets very wiry and complicated. There is no good solution here because they're both right and wrong, right? Because it's very difficult for people to get off Google, as an example.
Yes.
So, I don't know.
I'm fine with saying vote with your feet and go to one of the alternatives if you're not simultaneously supporting the right of the major company to destroy all the alternatives.
Yeah.
All right, what's next?
What's next?
So since I seem to be the one constantly banging on about security and privacy, did you see that Krebs on Security posted none of Google's, and I did not realize they were up to 85,000 employees, has been phished in at least a full year after the company required all employees to now use the YubiKeys, which is a
I did not
security
see
key
that.
For
yeah.
yeah.
Brilliant.
That's fascinating.
It
it's
is.
Good to know.
It is. I would be really interested to see an equivalent stat, which is how many of them got completely screwed up by not being able to log in because they lost their YubiKey or flushed it down the toilet by accident or something.
Out of curiosity, do you both use, doesn't have to be a YubiKey, just any physical 2FA, not just SMS or something?
Physical in the sense of a device which is not my phone?
Do you use SMS? Please tell me you don't use SMS.
Well, not for a whole bunch of things.
Yeah,
so, Steam, for example, I have the Steam app installed and so on and so forth. Google, obviously, the Google app, you know, the notification thing pops up on my phone and I use that. But I don't have any non-phone physical devices to do 2FA.
Okay. Just curious.
I have a mix. I use a YubiKey for some things, and then I use the you know what's it called, the Google
Authenticator.
Authenticator.
The Google Authenticator. But I mainly use that. So, because the key thing, the problem with the key thing is if you forget it or if you you know, it's just another thing to worry about.
That's what I'm interested in. I think this is a brilliant idea, and it clearly demonstrates that are they actually YubiKeys that they're using?
Google, yes.
Yeah. And I think this demonstrates that they're a good idea and that they work. I would just be interested to hear the other side of the story about how many people just had to go home and miss half a day because they forgot their YubiKey that one day or something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Also, in terms of the study, I would like to know whether that information came from Google or whether that was independently received. Because I don't think Google's going to want to say, you know, yeah, we've had loads of people who've been phished.
Well, no, true. But equally, you're not supposed to flat out lie about it. It was reported by Google.
I was going
to
say, there's a difference between them not saying anything. It was a Google employee, okay. Google spokesperson. But they specifically said they weren't, which is different than not saying anything.
Yeah, exactly. You're not
allowed to actually go out there and lie about it. Fine, if a load of employees got phished, they don't have to take out front page ad.
You're not allowed to go out there and actually lie about it. Have you seen the current state of the media? the amount of lying that happens on a regular basis.
I said, and I was correct, you're not allowed to do it. Right, the fact that you could go ahead and do it anyway is the problem.
By definition, you're allowed to do it. You shouldn't, and I don't believe that Google has, by the way. I think Google are a good company.
No,
but there is an awful lot of lying happening in the world today.
That is fair comment. Yes, I'll give you that. So, a slightly cheery little extra technical thing. Have you seen Join PeerTube, or just PeerTube, it's actually called?
No.
It's basically federated YouTube. But you don't know that it's federated. You just go to... someone can serve up a video, and then when they watch the video, so the UI is just like YouTube, right? You just go to it, watch a video, bang. But it's actually being served not just from the server that it's published on, but also everyone else who's watching it at the same time, in the same way that BitTorrent works. So if loads of people are watching a thing, then you're not spending loads of money on bandwidth. This is not like... Right, so this is not like, you know, Mastodon or something where you decide, I'm going to move from Twitter to this and then suddenly I haven't got any mates.
Explain this again. How does this work again? Right,
so you know how BitTorrent works? Yeah. Where you decide to download a thing and you're downloading it from everyone else who's already downloading it at the same time as you.
Yeah.
This is like that for watching videos. So you publish a video on your website. So... if you publish a video on your website right now, didn't publish it on YouTube and include it, you actually published it on your site itself, someone came along and clicked the video, it would just stream it from your site.
From your server, yeah.
Yeah. This is a problem if a million people do it at once.
Yeah, which is why you put it on YouTube.
Yes, but...
I was going to say, is it a problem if a million people do it at once?
In 2018? If it's on YouTube, maybe not. If it's on your server, yeah, it is. Because your server will fall apart. But the thing I thought was interesting about this is it basically works like BitTorrent.
Now, big question here.
Yeah.
To use this thing, the people who are viewing the video...
they've got no idea. They don't have to sign up to anything. They don't even know it's being served from loads of different people. That's why I thought it was interesting.
So right. I have two this comments. Is not something in 2018, you have to... the ubiquity of high bandwidth sites for free, be it YouTube or other ones, to me makes this a non-issue. And because of the peering arrangements that they have signed and the way the internet works on the back end, this is not an issue in 2018, in my opinion. Also, if you read the PeerTube site, we recommend not to install PeerTube on low-end hardware or behind a weak connection. For example, on a Raspberry Pi with an ADSL connection, this could slow down all federations.
Yeah.
That's not how federations work. No.
Now, you see... I think
Jeremy Garcia is not a fan of this.
Blimey.
I stopped reading the rest when I saw that.
I think it's interesting for people who don't want to publish on YouTube for whatever reason, there is some kind of alternative which doesn't involve you get to eat the bandwidth for all of your videos.
Yeah, but if you don't want to publish on YouTube, you publish on
archive.org.
Or archive.org.
Have you tried watching videos on archive.org? I mean, I love it, and every time we've done videos for Bad Voltage, I've put them on there, but it's not actually very good at serving videos.
You're saying it's worse than a site that says could slow down all federations.
What I believe they're trying to avoid, though, is someone going, great, I'll publish my video on some incredibly slow thing, and then other people will eat my bandwidth for me and I don't have to participate. So it has the same kind of what would you call it from BitTorrent? People who just download a thing but then don't upload.
Leeches.
Leeches, thank you, is the word I'm looking for. So they're trying to avoid that. But I think it's interesting that someone's trying to do something that isn't just, fine, upload your video to someone else's server and live with it, or spend a load of money on bandwidth and
but
then your two options.
If you don't like YouTube, use Vimeo. Like, I'm assuming that the argument against this is YouTube is the big global Google conspiracy, and people and they spy on us, blah 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 blah. If you don't like that, use Vimeo.
I think this is the same.
Or use ArchiveDog, and it's a bit rubbish, but you can still use it.
I think this is for the same reason that your website is on your web server. It's not just Medium or Squarespace. Right?
Yeah,
you
I get that.
A certain, exactly. But why bother? I mean, if you don't like Squarespace, use
Wix. Hang on. You're comparing apples to oranges.
I don't think I am.
The reason why my website, I host it, and when I say I host it, I mean my brother hosts it,
yeah,
is because I have much more flexibility in how I can... in how I run my infrastructure, right? So, like, I care about my infrastructure being under my control. Content, whether it's images or whether it's videos that are basically going to be viewed and embedded, I'm fine with them living somewhere else under the requirement that I can get those videos back if I need them. Okay?
There's some stuff. I mean, I'll happily upload stuff to YouTube or whatever. But if it goes Bing or Google decide to cut my account off, as we discussed 5 minutes
ago.
Hang on,
if what goes Bing? If YouTube goes away?
No, my account goes away. If Google decide to cut my account off, which we just discussed 2 minutes ago. Right?
But what we're talking about, this PeerTube thing seems to be a solution designed for people who are worried about their accounts being cut off by Google. This is such a tiny proportion of people.
I think it's an approach which isn't just, let's pick half a dozen big people with loads of bandwidth and have them put ads on my videos. I think it's just a nice idea.
You don't have
idea.
To have ads in your videos. You can turn ads off. You have to specifically switch ads on YouTube to monetize
your
video.
Or as discussed, just not use YouTube, which is fine.
You could say, I don't want ads on my video, but if you upload a bunch of videos and they get loads of views, Google will put ads on them whether you like them or not. That's how they pay the bills, right?
Oh, no, the ad thing, right, fair enough,
but
I get that.
This is my point. I think there's
so
some
you pay to not have ads in your videos.
There is some value, I believe, in if you want to, exercising control over the stuff you publish in exactly the same way as you... And this is what that is.
Yeah, but the problem with this is that it only works if lots of people are using this.
No, it does. It's exactly...
If lots of people are on your site looking at that video, this works.
Yes,
right? Otherwise, if you have a site that... Like, take your site act, site... will put Linux Questions to one side because Linux Questions gets a lot of traffic. Like, our personal sites will get... a reasonable number of traffic, but it's not going to break the bank, okay? Because it's very specific, and people are usually looking for something very specifically. There's probably not going to be enough people looking... Like a blog post from 3 years ago with a PeerTube video embedded in it.
Yeah.
You're probably just going to be eating the bandwidth.
But that's the point. At that point, you're fine to serve the bandwidth because there aren't that many people looking at it.
But
it's a way of saying...
With this, surely... This works well if you've got a lot of people looking at your site, right? So if you've got 1,000 people on your site right now and they're watching the same video, then the bits from that video are distributed among those 1,000 people and your bandwidth is relatively low.
Yes.
I get that, right? So if you have a site that's got consistently high traffic, I see that there's a utilization for this.
Yes.
Not denying that. If you don't have a site that's got consistently high traffic, right? And most sites will have consistently high traffic on a few pieces of cornerstone content at any one time. And then, particularly with a blog, like your traffic slows down considerably for the older posts. Then what's going to happen is you'll be penalized for having less traffic because you have to
be penalized
dish
for
less traffic. Bandwidth.
Right. If you wanted to solve that problem a year ago, right, you go, okay, I don't want to upload my video to somewhere else. I want control over my infrastructure, this kind of thing. So you just upload an MP4 to your own website. If not that many people download it, nothing has changed. If lots of people suddenly start downloading it because you get slash dotted, then you don't suddenly get a huge spike in bandwidth. That to me seems an obviously good thing, right?
I agree. Or you can avoid the whole issue and just use YouTube or Vimeo.
Yes, you absolutely can. Just upload your stuff to YouTube.
I think to distill this down, because while this is an interesting conversation, we do have other news. I think John and I both think federated services are interesting, and we should probably have more federated services in general, because centralized authority of things on the internet is a bad thing for everyone. This seems like a solved problem, and it's just a video sheen on BitTorrent, which has existed forever. So
yeah, I'm
surprised it led to this much discussion.
we were talking before we started recording about how sometimes you don't expect a lot of discussion on certain things, and sometimes you get a lot. So yeah,
but that means ipso facto it is interesting.
I think it's interesting. I do think it's interesting because it's pointless.
Okay.
No, it's not. It's a good idea, and I see the point of it, and it does have value. I'll give you that. So.
That's all I wanted to hear. Your go. Yeah.
Is it me or is it Jeremy?
It is you.
It is me. Gita Van Rossum, Kingping in Python, is stepping down from being Python's benevolent dictator for life, because apparently the arguments are getting a little too heated. And this was announced, what was it, a couple of weeks ago, right?
Yeah, it was July the 12th. So
we were going to touch on this in the we were going to record last week, but schedules became a little bit complicated because Jeremy and I were at OSCON, so we didn't get to it. But I think it's still important and interesting. Now, you're the resident Python expert here, Aquarius. What do you think about this?
He wrote a post called Transfer of Power. Now, he has been talking about kind of stepping down or stepping away or whatever for quite a while now. I don't want to give the impression that there was a bunch of really big arguments and he went and stormed down the door. No, he's got to be
kind of right.
I didn't follow
Pep 572. I'm sure, Jono, you didn't. Did you, Langridge?
No,
because he specifically called it out in the email, which makes you think it was kind of a little of
I just want to actually quote the thing. So he started off his email, he called it Transfer of Power. And he said, now that PEP 572 is done, I don't ever want to have to fight so hard for a PEP and find that so many people despise my decisions. And to be honest with you, PEP 572 is a pretty obscure language tweak to Python,
Assignment expressions, right?
Assignment expressions, yeah. So, you know, not going to bore you with the detail, but this is not any kind of massively world-shaking thing. It changes a few bits about how some Python stuff works, adds an extra feature to the language, but it's not that big a deal, but it's become the world's largest bike shed, as far as I can tell. Backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, and people arguing in quite an intemperate sort of way. And it's one of those things where you had a whole bunch of people who kind of, I believe this to be the case, and someone standing up against it was seen as a personal insult, and he got into a really big fight and everything. And I think Hido was kind of, I don't like making decisions and having a whole bunch of people hate me for it. Right? Yeah. Not interested in doing that. And to be honest with you, this surprised me a bit, because it's Python, right? Some communities tend to be like that, but much as I love Python to bits, it is a programming language for people who religiously floss every day, right?
I think part of the interesting thing...
For people who say darn instead of proper swear words, right? You can't imagine there being a huge bun fight.
I've never heard it described that way before.
I personally kind of am fascinated by the whole Pythonic way, where there's really only one recommended way to do things. I think part of this is that the first language I learned, and I was paid to be a Perl programmer for multiple years, where there's 11,000 ways to do every single thing. So the Pythonic way intrigues me. I don't know how you enforce that without a BDFL, so it's going to be interesting. There's quite a few Python language features that were kind of blocked on Guido not wanting them, from pattern matching to inline exception to path inclusions in the built-in processes. So a whole bunch of things were basically not in there because he didn't want them in there. So it's going to be interesting to see how the language progresses moving forward without him. The one thing that I don't know if disappointed is the correct word, but that he left it and didn't appoint a person or people or some kind of core maintainer group, that he just kind of said, you'll all figure it out. I think what has been a really great thing.
I don't think that's fair. He did indeed. He did not appoint a successor, but I think that's because it's not because he doesn't know which successor to pick. It's because he's not sure of the model of having a BDFL in the first place. I mean, you could appoint, there are half a dozen people, you know, Barry Warsaw or someone like that. Barry's already fluffle. You make him BDFL and there right. you go, done, right? But I think he's more kind of thinking, maybe this isn't the way of doing it. Maybe putting someone up on a pedestal and then having everyone hurl shit at them until they get sick of it and leave. They write a leaving email which ends with, I'll still be here, but I'm trying to let you all figure out something for yourselves. I'm tired and I need a very long break. A model which makes people feel like that maybe is the wrong model. Maybe they should have a voting thing or something. So I think, I don't think he left because he wanted to leave them in the lurch. I think it's because maybe there should be a different model and someone needs to decide. He just doesn't want to
be part of that. Sure, but he should, in my opinion, be part of the decision-making process for that model. Leaving it with, so what are you all going to do? Create a democracy, an anarchy, a dictatorship, a federation?
It sounds like what's happening here is that he's basically burnt out.
Yeah.
And he just wants done with it.
Yeah.
And
totally.
So I agree with you, Jeremy, but it sounds like he's I don't know the specifics of the situation. This is going to lead to a question, actually. It sounds like he's burning out and therefore is not handling it in the most optimal way. My question, though, that relates to this, because I haven't seen how these PEPs have been formed and how the sausage is made. There are some communities that are very aggressive, and there are personal attacks, and there are blah, 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 blah. There are some communities that are very, very, there's a lot of fierce discussion, but they're always very respectful and dignified. How would you describe the Python community? Like, would you describe it as, like, there are personal attacks, that it's a nasty place to be around?
No, really, no. I mean, this was why...
Because that's why I've never thought of it as being a place like that, which would suggest that he's burning out and therefore he's like...
Well, this is the point. I think the discussions on this seemed to me, to my limited knowledge of the core dev stuff, right, the discussions and the temperature of the discussions on this particular relatively obscure language change seem to be wildly out of line with what's normal. I don't think that is... I don't think that it is all actually quite nice and he's massively overreacting because he's burned out. I think this was really quite unpleasant and unusually unpleasant. And... Right. Unusually for the Python community as a whole. As I say, I mean, I don't pay that much attention to core dev stuff. As far as I can tell, the language was fine with Python 3.2. Just leave it alone and stop fiddling with it. but this, it is a sign that even as fluffy a community as the Python community can be so intemperate that the guy who built the language leaves because he wants no more of it.
Yeah, well, Guido, we wish you the best.
Yes, you know, I'm
absolutely.
Awesome.
I mean, you created a really great thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We did. It's still the language I turn to for everything. Right? First thing I always do is write stuff in Python.
Yeah.
Always.
Oh, God, though, whenever I think of him, it just reminds me of when I had breakfast, didn't realize it was him, and we were having this conversation about tokenizing, like building interpreters and compilers. I have no idea what I was talking about. And I was just trying to hold on, trying to talk a big game. It's earlier in my career. Hey, nice chatting to you. I'm Jono. Yeah, hi. Nice chatting to you. I'm Guido van Rossum. Oh, you mean the creator of Python?
You.
That guy?
Wow.
Yeah.
I've never heard that story. Why have I never heard that story?
Yeah, this is the morning, second day of Foo Camp in 2006, I think it was. And I said to him, everything I just said in the last 45 minutes, please ignore.
Excellent.
Because it was nonsense. So, yeah. So, my apologies, Guido.
That's, That's outstanding.
This was total horseshit. Everything out of my mouth was total horseshit. Yeah. I thought I was trying.
This is a man who shits more knowledge about parcels daily than you've had in your entire life.
Precisely.
Excellent work, Jonathan Bacon. That's absolutely superb. Flying the flag there. Well played. Right, Jeremy.
Well, I think we should probably think about... We're nearly out of time.
There is so much news to it. We are...
should we do one more? Well, let's do one more.
Okay.
There's so many good ones. I'm going to let you two choose. I'm going to give you two, and we'll pick one. And
okay.
The other one, we'll discuss in the forum.
Yes, good plan.
So do you want to discuss the hilarious debacle that was NPM, or do you want to discuss the fact that the Labour Party micro-targeted Jeremy Corbyn with Facebook ads?
I'm up for the Labour Party thing.
I'm up for the Labour because I'm bored of NPM, so I'm very much up for the Labour Party one.
Okay.
Go on.
So I don't know if one of the two of you want to explain this, maybe act, but it's so to my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Jeremy Corbyn himself wanted a few things, his campaign money spent in a couple ways that some of his staff didn't necessarily agree with. So instead of spending a ton of money broadly advertising this thing, they spent a little bit of money, it seems like about £5,000 roughly, on targeting specifically him, people that they knew were important to him, and journalists that they knew that he spoke with, so that he would think it was advertised.
Yeah.
Is that correct? And this was his own party doing this.
Yeah, that is correct. This is official in the Labour Party, the party that he runs, basically doing an ad campaign, which essentially only he saw, and going, yeah, we had a massive ad campaign, lol. And he went, okay, seems fine to me. I even saw the ad.
Oh, what a world we live in on multiple different contexts of this story.
This is so silly on so many different levels.
It's one of those things where you can't help but laugh at it. And then your brain goes, oh my God, massively important ramifications to this kind of thing. And then you laugh again afterwards, right? There was a Sunday Times journalist who said, I'll find the quote. When the leader of a political party can be tricked in such a way by his own officials, voters themselves stand little chance. And you think, yeah, that's really terrifying. And then you think, but isn't it really amusing?
That is such a grim synopsis.
I don't buy that, though, because there is a difference between the relationship between a voter and Jeremy Corbyn and his trusted officials.
Yeah,
right?
No. I don't think that's the point he was trying to make. I think the point he was trying to make is look at how accurately and closely you can micro-target something. You can, you know how people talk about living in a bubble.
If this can be done by your own party, imagine what else can be done. Is the broader
imagine what can be done by the opposition party? Is the point? You know, when we talk about living in a bubble, right? With this, you could essentially put someone else in a bubble without them being aware of it. That seems quite worrying to me. But equally, it's hilarious. Right?
Yeah. There is. Yeah. I think we should maybe utilize this this realization for our amusement. Let's pick someone. Let's pick someone that we're going to target who's just a very nice person and kind of weed them out a little bit just for the sake of it. What about Todd Lewis? From All Things Open, he's too nice. No, Alan, like Jeremy Spass.
I don't believe we will set out to deliberately destroy someone's mind. Thank you very much.
It wouldn't be nice, would it? Wouldn't be nice.
Yeah.
So the interesting in doing a little bit of research for this one, there is actually a service now where you can target your significant other with specific ads. This is a service that exists in real life.
Are you joking?
I
shouldn't have said, sorry, Erica.
I'm going to start tagging Erica with amazing thematic trousers.
So I don't understand it, Jono. Everywhere on every site I look at, I just see ads for Rickenback and guitars. I don't get it. No, do not do
get
this sort of thing.
Get your special something, this incredibly expensive guitar.
Right. Yeah. Right, that'll do us. We did like half the news. But
not enough news. We'll be back and talk about the other one on the forum.
My daughter is 18, right? And And this gives you a chance to... I know, isn't it terrifying?
No, she'll always be like six. It's okay. Can't believe she's a woman.
And you do, you know, this kind of thing happens and you look back and take stock on your life and so on and so forth. One of the things that came up in various discussions is, after I die, who gets the stuff, which is her? But then what happens to the increasing percentage of my stuff, which is digital? Right? And so I started poking around and looking into this question. And there are various different approaches you can take, various different software-based approaches to giving people your passwords or giving people access to your accounts and so on and so forth. But so I'd like, first of all, I'm interested in whether you've got any particular advice on these things. But more interestingly is the kind of underlying issue. I mean, I don't think I want people to have access to my email account. And so there's kind of a bigger picture, not just if you decide you want to hand over the keys to the kingdom to someone after you die, how do you do that? But how do you decide what, if anything, you want to hand over? And are you going to sit down and delineate all the digital stuff you've ever done into, yes, they can have this, no, they can't have this, which clearly no one's going to do. So I'm interested in what preparations you've already made for this kind of thing and how you've handled it.
I have a simple answer to that question. I've made no preparations for this topic. I mean, it's one of those. I think of this in a similar way to having a will, right? Like thinking about what happens upon your death is not a subject that most people like to think about, and I think people put it off. And you know, that's why people put off getting life insurance or putting a will in place or whatever else, and then you then realize, oh, actually, I really need to have that. And that stuff's obvious to me, but this is not obvious. Like, what happens?
Yeah.
And I think, more to the point,
they're not the same thing. If you die intestate, which for Jono's purposes means without a will, not without testicles. if you die without a will, there are rules in place to show what happens. And because your stuff is physical, I mean, essentially, it'll be everything goes to Erica for you, right? But the point is that the stuff you own is physical. She gets your guitars, for example. But she can't get your email account because if she doesn't know the password, there's no way to give it to her unless you prepared for that ahead of time. It's like if she got the house, but you had the only door key and you were buried with it, right? So she can't get in.
Yeah, well, it's odd as well because there are so many layers to this, right? Like one element is access, right? So arguably, so long as Erica's got my phone, she could get access to my account because, you know, the two-factor authentication thing will send a code to the phone.
And your severed thumb, presumably.
Well, yeah, but I mean, not everybody's got, you know, a biometric sensor on their devices, whatever else. So there's ways around that. But I think this becomes infinitely more complicated particularly for public figures. So for the three of us, we're not public figures. So reasonably, this is about our families getting access to this kind of stuff. But, you know, I can absolutely foresee, for example, a politician dying and then their account being misused for various purposes, for, you know, fabricating information or whatever it might be. Like I think the risk goes up when you depending on the kind of person that you are. So it's not just access, but it's like, what can you then do with that access? So we typically see this with Facebook as an example. Like, do you remember, I won't say his name because I don't know if his family are listening and it might be a difficult subject, but there was a guy in the Linux community, came to Bad Voltage Live a few times. He passed away, and he had like an auto thing set up in his Facebook account that would basically send out news. So he died, but he was still like sending out news and commentary, which I think he would have found quite funny. But that's just a small anomaly. But what happens, there's the public consideration, then there's the private content consideration, then there's like what people can do with that. I don't know.
So I guess I'm curious, Ack, why you think it's so different than non-digital stuff. You said unlike the keys to the house, you can't get it. To my understanding, every major provider has a next of kin policy. Certainly Google does. Certainly Facebook does. Certainly almost any major institution is going to have that. So I guess it seems like if you grew up 100 years ago and you died with a bunch of letters in a box and you didn't want people to see them, the box was there. Just as if now your email is there and your property.
Well, people have, Google have the inactive account manager, for example, which you can go to and fill in explicitly what should happen in these situations. But the next of kin policy, I'm not necessarily sure when you say they've got a next of kin policy, if those next of kin rock up after you've died and say, I want access to the account, I'm not at all sure they'll give it to you. Facebook,
so for Google, you need
to...
your full name, your physical mailing address, your email, a photocopy of your government-issued driver's license, the Gmail address or Google username that you would like access to of the deceased user, the death certificate. I mean, there's a specific list of things you give them, and then they give you access.
No, that's interesting. I mean, Facebook, they let you appoint what they call a legacy contact who can take over your account after you've died, and they'll allow people who knew you to notify Facebook that you have died, and they will then memorialize your account. So yes, it stops showing up on people's walls and stuff. But as far as I can tell, I mean, I may have missed this, but there doesn't seem to be any provision for someone to show up after you've died who, and you didn't appoint them as your legacy contact and say, they're dead, I want access to the account. And I'm not at all sure I actually want that anyway, right?
This
is kind of the larger question. How are you, even if you just hand wave it and go, well, fine, they'll be able to get access to it after I'm dead if they show up with my death certificate and their driving license or whatever. Do you want people to be able to do that?
But hang on, let me understand you correctly. You're saying that, so Jeremy's said that there's a process and a workflow that someone goes through to set what happens in the event of someone dying,
yeah,
right? And Ack, it sounds like what you're saying is, what happens if you haven't gone through that process? What happens in that situation?
Well,
and but if you haven't gone through that process, do you want someone rucking up and claiming
let me clarify a bit. Most major services, so password managers, Google, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, will allow you to set up and explicitly say, if I die, this person gets this account. No problem with that. If you've explicitly decided to do that, you obviously want that. No worries. If you die without doing that, some services will allow your next of kin to show up and go, they're dead, they didn't appoint me, here's a bunch of proof that they're dead and I'm their next of kin, I want access to the account.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Not all services allow that, but I mean, for example, your desktop computer doesn't allow it. And then the step beyond that is, are we okay with this?
With what?
I'm not necessarily sure that I want my family to be able to get access to everything. And so should I be putting provision in place to have stuff time bomb or something? I mean, take the list of letters you mentioned earlier, Jeremy, right? So, yeah, you've got a bunch of letters you exchange with people from before your kids were born or whatever. Maybe you don't want the family to read them. There are countless examples of people wanting their partially finished novels destroyed after they died. And some people didn't,
so
some
I guess
people
my,
didn't,
my
and so on.
Broader point, which was maybe not well articulated, is that I see, in this day and age, I see your digital footprint, if you will, as an outcropping of your physical footprint. So you should take whatever provisions that you deem necessary for you to ensure that it is or is not released, just like you should with your physical goods. And I guess I don't see a big differentiator between digital and physical these days, because digital is such an extension of yourself. So having good hygiene around all these things, I think, is important, something that probably isn't taken as seriously as it should be. But I don't see digital being... Some of the technicalities are different, and some of the specifics around how it would be accomplished are different. But to me, it's once you build out the framework of who you want to have access to what, whether it's digital or physical, is implementation detail more than anything else to me.
Actually, no, that's interesting. I take almost a view from the... I arrive at roughly the same point, but I take a view almost from the opposite direction. I care considerably more whether someone can pretend to be me on Twitter after I've died than I do about who gets my saucepans. Right? I don't actually think the physical stuff is very important at all. Wherever I'm dead, no idea. You know, it doesn't matter.
It's your legacy, isn't
but
it?
But I care quite a lot.
You're saying that your legacy
more.
Could be compromised. I understand.
I care quite a lot more about access to my digital stuff than I do to the physical stuff. And partially that's because there are a bunch of procedures and laws in place already for physical stuff. If you die, everything you owned goes to your next of kin, unless you wrote a will. But if you die, everything doesn't automatically go to your next of kin digitally, because they might not have access to it.
Depending where you live, that first thing's very much not true, but okay.
Really?
What do you mean?
No, I mean the variety of states have a variety of different rules and laws.
Oh, okay, right. There is some procedure in place for what happens if you die intestate. Right? I don't know what that is right now. But yeah.
So if your next of kin then doesn't get it or has to wait years to get it and lives destitute, I would argue that's very much not the case, but okay.
Okay, no,
so,
that's fair.
So hang on. So there are procedures in place for these services for you to... like, intentionally nominate a person.
Yes.
Right? Who gets access. That's squared away. For some of these services, there is a procedure where if you didn't nominate a person, the default next of kin through your other legal means can provide ID and provide evidence of that, and they can get access. But that doesn't apply to all services.
Sure.
Now, are you saying, ACT, that you want a provision in place where... you know, when you die, you don't want your family discovering your hoard of goat pornography. So you want to have the ability for to reject access to anybody else? Is that what you're talking about?
I don't know what I think about this. Exactly the reason I brought this up is that I don't know whether everyone else in the world has already squared this away to their own satisfaction. And no. I just don't know about it.
I don't think so. I don't think anyone's even... I think a lot of people listening to this right now, it's the first time they've thought about
Which is the other reason I'm bringing it up. Because I think there are a whole bunch of startups, basically, who are kind of, your digital will, and you basically, you know, you give us all of your passwords and we'll unlock them when you die. And like, first of all, no. Secondly, no. And thirdly, I'm not at all convinced that these people will be around years and years from now when you two die. Me, since I'll probably die, you know, next year or something. Maybe different. But
not a whole lot of confidence.
But, wow. You know, I mean... I honestly don't think that I'd sign up for some service that got set up 18 months ago with the intention that they'll still be around and able to give my passwords out 30 years from now without being also unsure they might give away my passwords 15 years from now when they get sold. Right? So there are provisions in place for really big things. Google have it. Facebook have it. Twitter and LinkedIn and Instagram let you memorialize an account. Snapchat has nothing. But you mentioned the phone, right? Jono, nobody can log into my phone. I mean, fine, if they've got access to my Google account, then presumably they can unlock the phone from inside my Google account.
Well, can't you, a lot of phones, if you don't pass the fingerprint thing, it asks you to use the swipey thing, the swipey passcode thing.
Yeah,
does your phone not do that?
Yeah, but the point is that nobody knows mine. No one knows by the PIN for my phone. Of me.
Yeah, but you could, I mean, you could put something like that. You could document that, right?
I could yes.
There are ways around it. You don't want to use someone's dead fingerprint.
I do not, but equally...
That's a social faux pas.
Equally, I would feel extremely, extremely leery about getting a piece of paper with, here is how you unlock everything I own, and then putting it somewhere. Writing that stuff down would be weird. Have you ever had... years and years and years ago, this was, I used to use passwords which were kind of obscure words, right? Rather than the whole bunch of mixed up punctuation like you do now. And every now and again, you'd see one of your words, like on a page or something, and get a little electric shock of, oh, that's my password. Or if you accidentally type a password into a wrong window or into a terminal or something, you go, oh my God, that's my password. And you hardly ever see it actually written out. Having a piece of paper like that would be terrifying.
I had someone recently asked me to email them a password of mine, and I had to say no 3 or 4 times, and they couldn't understand why. I was like, no, this is not what we do. What we'll do is we'll have a phone call, and I will give you each letter and symbol, but there's going to be no emailing of passwords.
How hard is Jono, but with the O's replaced by zeros? That doesn't seem that complicated.
I was going to say, joke. I am a little surprised and quite proud of you, sir.
Yes, well done. We should pause for a moment and genuinely embrace
my Jono. My security is not that bad. I have 2-factor authentication on a bunch of my accounts. I use a password manager. So you guys can go fuck yourself.
Well, you see, okay? there's another thing, right? To give you an example, right? So major cloud storage password stuff like LastPass and Dashlane and stuff like that, they both have a way of nominating an emergency access person. Or an emergency access procedure. So you die, someone can get access to your accounts, right? But 2-factor authentication makes that a bit of a problem. Because even if someone's got all your passwords, if you've got 2FA turned on, they still can't log into whatever this thing is. And if you're setting up this kind of emergency procedure, you've got to also worry about what happens if someone works out a way around it.
This is true.
This was the whole thought. As you said, there's an awful lot to think about in this subject, and I'm nowhere near convinced I know what the hell I even want to do, let alone how to do it.
I think this is one of those things where this is, to all intents and purposes, a solved problem, but it's a solved problem in the same way that being able to record TV shows digitally and play them back was a quote-unquote solved problem back in 2006. Is that you could go and buy a Myth TV, you could build a Myth TV computer, you could install Myth TV, you could set it all up, you could configure it, you could configure your remote control, that kind of stuff. But it was a massive bollock to do it, and very few people actually had the skills and the knowledge to do so. But it could be done. I think this is one of those situations where you can do this, but I think the UI with the human race is too complicated. Because first of all, people have to know that this is something they should think about, which I don't think most people do.
Right.
And then secondly, You've got to understand all of these different elements, because it's not just about how do you do this with each of these digital assets, but what happens, like, what is the relationship to this stuff when it comes to a will? What happens if you have a trust for your family or for your kids? Like, how does all this stuff relate to that? And it's just incredibly complicated.
Yeah,
so,
I was going to say, I think most of the work here is a very personal piece of deciding what you, Stuart Langridge, the individual, want. And then from there, making sure each service you use conforms to that thing. And that's a lot of work.
Oh, it is, totally. Yeah. And anything other than all to the family or delete the lot, as far as I can tell, basically requires you to go through and tag everything you've touched with family or bin. Right?
Yeah.
And nobody's ever going to do that.
The most important question for all of this is, when I worked at GitHub, there was this cool little office meeting room with a hidden door that twisted around, and there was a secret office in there. And in front of the secret office area of the GitHub office, there was a old MacBook in a glass box, and there was a little sticker on the side that said, "This is where Chris Ronstroth filed the first pull request ever on GitHub." And it was there as this little kind of like computer history museum kind of like memento. Now, in the earlier annals of Bad Voltage, Stuart Langridge used to record his audio on a Spectrum 48K in his bedroom without a webcam attached. And I would like to make sure that when you die next week or whenever it is, Langridge, that I get that. Because I want to put it in a glass box and I want to display it somewhere. Can I have it, please?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. There we go.
That's a physical item. That's no problem. I'll just write it in the will. No worries.
Oh, also, I want access to all of your digital stuff. No. Because I'm going to have some fun with you. They would be great, actually, to be able to troll from beyond the grave. No, not troll, but like to be able to just send out the odd message here and there on Facebook.
So you appoint like a troll executor. Someone to continue your legacy after you're gone.
Yeah, I think that would be fun. I mean, not necessarily like, you know, bad troll, but just like drop the odd amusing, like, "Guys, warm in here."
Right. This is why, A, you're not in charge, and B, you're not my executor. So, end of the show. Yeah, I do actually have a question, because someone asked a question on Twitter. So, you've got a guy called Peter Paris, he tweeted at Bad Voltage and asked us a question, and it's a serious question, right? So, you've got, like, one or two sentence answer only. He says, how does one define an expert in Linux? One who is skilled with only one type of distro, Debian, or a jack-of-all-trades understanding of several kinds? So, couple of sentences only, rather than this being a segment, which it probably could have been.
That is a good question.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you could be an expert in a variety of different aspects of Linux, right? You could be a RHEL expert, or you could be a Debian expert, or you could be a Linux networking expert, or all or none. Or, I mean, I don't see them as mutually exclusive. So,
personally,
I'm not sure you could say this person is an expert and actually have any real understanding of what that means or what they could do. I remember hearing a story by a guy called Raymond Chen, who works for Microsoft, on the Shell team. And he writes a very entertaining weblog. And he said that people have asked them for years, like since Windows 1, why isn't there an expert mode where instead of hiding stuff away, it shows you all the details and all the checkboxes that are otherwise hidden. So people like us, power users, can actually get at stuff rather than having it hidden from us. And he said the problem has always been that you start up and you ask people the question, do you want to run this in expert mode? And someone who's a brilliant Excel person will go, yeah, I'm an expert, even though they know nothing about the shell at all, and will tick it, and then will be hugely confused.
Yeah, it's a good point. I would say as well, expertise has got scope, right? So so to Jeremy's point, you could be a RHEL expert, but that would make you pretty useless in something like Debian.
Indeed otherwise.
Right. And if you are a general Linux expert, I believe you can be an expert, but you're probably going to have less depth across all of those different distros.
Yeah. So, I mean, you look at the three of us, right? I mean, I'm a reasonably good programmer, good at strategic stuff and planning and architecture and stuff like that, but I know nothing about the kernel. I know very little about networking. Jeremy, you're good at sort of infrastructure and containers and management and all that sort of thing. But then how much do you know about JavaScript coding? Not a lot. Same kind of thing, right?
Exactly. So, I'm not sure if we answered your question, but you know, we're not really here to answer questions because we're really not expertise. We don't have any expertise on that question.
Well put. So, yes, that was Bad Voltage, Series 2, Episode 35. Hope you enjoyed it.
Yes, it was a good time. We will see you in a few weeks, people. Have fun.